You're listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. So, Andy Cook, a very warm welcome to the podcast today. Thank you for donating your time.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
I suppose you're going to be leaving the law enforcement arena for the second time in your career now. And I suppose with that comes a period of reflection. So maybe we could start this podcast with perhaps looking at some of the standout moments for you personally over the last however many years you've been in policing now. Good and bad, I suppose.
Sure. I mean, nearly 41 years now involved in policing. I've got to say from the start, I've loved every day I've been involved with it. Not every day has been a good day. You have your ups and downs during any career. You know, you have your disappointments. You have the times that you wish you didn't see things that you saw. You didn't have to do things that you had to do. But no, it's been an absolute pleasure to be involved in policing for that long. You know, some of the highs going back, I mean, being accepted as a police officer. I've wanted to be a police officer since I was about 3 foot tall. It's the career I always wanted to do. I think it was vocational for me. No one in my family was in the police, so I wasn't following anyone's footsteps. But for some reason, it's what I always wanted to do. And the day I joined the police, I was exceptionally proud. So were my family. Becoming a detective, I love being a detective. Some of the opportunities to really deal with some of the toughest crimes, to investigate some really bad people, put them into prison, which I love doing. I spent a lot of time doing citizen organised crime and covert policing. So many opportunities, such a wide variety of roles that I've been able to do. You know, getting a knighthood for a lad from, you know, an estate in Liverpool, getting those sorts of heights and meeting the king and you name it. I mean, it's just been incredible. But I owe it all to people who have worked with over the years. I mean, too many fantastic people to mention, too many people whose footsteps have followed in. But it does bring you back to the fact that, you know, I'm lucky. With what I've achieved, I'm lucky. I've loved every minute, but I'm lucky. On a daily basis, I mean, my ex-colleagues, those police officers, police staff, just do a fantastic job. So the compassion, the bravery, the professionalism. Policing gets a bad name sometimes and the confidence levels aren't great at the moment. But, you know, when you've been in the career for as long as I have, it's just as good today as it was then. It's a different job. But, you know, you've got to admire and respect all those involved in it.
You mentioned the confidence levels, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. But I'm just curious, was there one person in your career, I mean, certainly my career as a police officer, my very first tutor kind of moulded me and made me the officer that I became. I'm just wondering if there was a person in your career that did something similar.
No, look, absolutely. My first tutor, a chap called Jerry Harris, he sadly passed away now. He was incredible. He was just so dedicated, so determined to do a good job, so proactive. He taught me all the right things that a young cop needed to know. He was outstanding, you know, and I always look back and I thank the fact that he was my tutor constable. He taught me how to do things the right way, and he made the job exciting. Throughout my career, I've had people who, you know, have had a big impact on me. Yeah, again, too many to mention, and I don't want to flatter anyone by mentioning them by name. But even, you know, some people have reached really senior ranks, but not just those. There's been others throughout that career who have just been really good people to learn the job from. And I think that's how police officers do improve. It's by looking at the good people who are doing the right things and following them.
Mm. Well, it's fair to say you've pretty much occupied every role at every rank within operational policing. I think you finished off as Chief Constable of Merseyside before then retiring. I hate retirement, it's such a final word, isn't it? But then you went on to the HMIC FRS.
I did.
So perhaps And you'll have probably a better handle on UK policing PLC as a whole, probably more than anybody.
Mm.
So just looking at that and all the reviews, the peer inspections, what are some of the changes in policing that you've seen in your tenure as the head of the HMIC FRS? And again, good and bad, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first came as the inspectorate, it was right at the tail end of the austerity period, just gone through COVID. And, you know, it was a tough time for policing. We saw the 20,000 officers being returned over a short period of time, which caused its own problems, obviously. But it was good to get those officers back. I mean, I think in that period, something I was being really determined to push in my state of policing reports and any time I spoke, was that getting back to neighbourhood policing, getting back to the basics. And by the basics, I don't mean Dixon or Dock Green. You know, this is about doing the things that keep communities safe and let communities see they're being kept safe, like answering the phone quickly, responding quickly, being compassionate, being caring, keeping victims informed, hopefully catching the person responsible for the offence that's being committed and the reason they called you in the first place. They're the basics that people see on a daily basis. So when we look at the confidence issues and we think, you know, why is confidence so poor? I genuinely link it to the move away from neighbourhood policing during austerity by some forces, to the not just the issues of the despicable people who've been arrested and you know, committed heinous crimes whilst wearing police uniforms. I mean, that's bad enough, but I think people are generally seeing that policing hasn't dealt well with the smaller issues that they see on the doorstep every day, and they haven't had the right response from the police or a quick response from the police. That is the least the public demand, and it's what policing should be giving them.
Mm. I think from my own personal experience and what I've seen around me when I was serving is that the police historically have been pretty bad at communicating their position when they're called out. And not only that, just updating victims of crime and things like that. You know, everybody knows that the police are busy, but sometimes it's just good to hear why we can't do something in the time frame that perhaps somebody would expect us to do.
Absolutely right. And, you know, it's a shame. Policing needs to get better communication, undoubtedly. It is getting better. I mean, we've got some great people who work in comms departments across policing, but it's given them the ability to actually put the right messages out in the first place without that fear factor that sometimes goes alongside that. You know, I spoke about this in the report after the disorder, about actually getting the right information out quickly, because if you don't, someone will put the wrong information out. The amount of misinformation and disinformation now with social media and other forums that people share information on. Policing needs to get the right information out quickly to reassure communities. It needs to do it in the right way, and it can't hide behind this might impact on something in the future. Yes, they can't say too much about certain issues, but they can say certainly more than they do and quicker than they do, and in a better way of communicating than they do, and getting on the right communication channels to do that.
I mean, news vacuums are very quickly filled with what we call these social auditors now, with these people with everybody's a journalist, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, and it puts enormous pressure on policing, you know, frontline officers as well as, you know, senior officers. That vacuum needs to be filled. But there are times when it's important that the police fill it in the right way and fill it quickly.
So can you think of perhaps one or two examples of where, because I don't want to dwell on the negative, there's enough of that going around, but one or two things that overall for UK policing PLC have been big improvements on, just across the board, really, I suppose.
Yeah, look, I think neighbourhood policing is improving. The government are driving it through the neighbourhood policing guarantee, and I'm fully supportive of that. We are seeing now policing being better at embracing some of the AI and the tech capabilities, some really innovative approaches from certain forces who are doing really good things, but that needs to be put right out across all 43 forces, not just individual forces, which are one of the weaknesses of policing. We're seeing a rise in detection rates and that focus on the operational, which I think police lost too much time to a bit of navel gazing over the last 5-10 years. everything policing does needs to be based upon the public outcome for it. So we are seeing those detection rates start to increase now and the offences brought to justice are getting better. I think senior policing lost a focus on performance and how to actually manage and drive performance over a number of years going back. We're seeing the return to that as well. I mean, you've got some really good chief constables out there really pushing that real drive to make sure that people are kept safe by doing what policing should be doing, which is those basics.
Well, that very nicely brings us on to the government white paper on police reform, which was published in January of this year, I think. It's the most radical structural change in 200 years. It looks to merge the National Crime Agency, the counter-terrorist policing, the ROCUs, regional organised crime units and national bodies into a single force to become the National Police Service. So it looks like the end of the 43-force model, which the white paper says is no longer fit for purpose. So I'd be delighted to hear your views on that paper.
Yeah, look, I think if that white paper is carried out in its entirety, it will do what it should do, which is make communities safer. I'm a massive supporter of it. I have been fortunate enough to be able to influence that white paper to a significant extent alongside other leaders in policing. The government have listened to policing in relation to it, which is great to see. You know, a lot of this has been driven by people within policing. So right through it, from greater control for the Home Secretary to a smaller number of forces, to changes in powers in certain places, to drive in police AI, to stopping a lot of the waste that we see in policing with the 43 forces purchasing different IT systems, purchasing different vehicles. There's a lot of public money being wasted in relation to that, and it's not always for the benefits of the public. Getting that grip on what is a much changed operating theatre for police in this country now than it has been previously is really important, because policing isn't local anymore. The local part of that policing is really important to protect. So I'm not saying it shouldn't be local. As we look at how we're going to strengthen the sort of, you know, capabilities at the top end, we also need to ensure that we are giving the right service to local communities at the other end of it. Now, just because there's less forces doesn't mean that won't happen. You can have local policing and bigger forces. It depends on how you're actually governing that approach and how you actually place your resources in the first place. So I think this is a really good opportunity to professionalise policing, to increase the standards of policing across the country and get rid of that postcode lottery we've had for too long, where some forces are good and some forces aren't, and to actually ensure that the public of this country get the policing service that they quite rightly deserve and they should be getting. You cannot get that anymore with this 43-force approach.
So certainly one of my worries, I suppose, is, and you've touched on neighbourhood policing and the local implementation of that, is that the danger is that in a big region, police officers and resources will be pulled away from those smaller areas to service the larger crime centres.
No, look, I think if the government and policing gets this right, I think you will see a better local policing approach, a more consistent local policing approach. Because at the moment, I mean, the reality is, Dave, and I've reported on this a few times, neighbourhood officers are the first people to be chosen to be pulled away for whatever else is happening elsewhere. So they are not having the time to problem solve in their own communities, to actually get those contacts in communities, to deal with the local issues that are happening, because they're being drawn away to either response or to protest or something else. So actually getting a better approach to that resource management in a smaller number of forces, I think, will be far easier to do. And those forces then will have the numbers to actually deal with most of the issues that are facing them. Getting the right standards on that, getting a far clearer approach to, you know, what training police officers need to do the various different parts of the job, whatever specialism they're in, and I include neighbourhood policing and response in the specialism approach as well, will be far better for policing. So as long as the governance is right, as long as the processes are right, that the right IT is used, that police do embrace the technology that's coming forward now, which will release more people onto the streets, if we save more money through those procurement angles and making, and, you know, and stopping individual chiefs or PCCs buying whatever piece of kit they think is the right thing that doesn't necessarily speak to the next force along, or even sometimes within their own force, I think police will be far more professional. I think the public will get a far better service, and it will release money to have more cops on the front line.
Now, set out in the white paper is the new police performance framework, national targets, and possible increased powers for yourselves at the HMIC FRS to issue binding directions to ensure a consistent level of service. How will the proposed changes differ from what is currently in place?
Well, the police performance framework was actually brought forward by the inspectorate. To a report that I did a couple of years ago called Getting a Grip, said that the police need a national performance framework because there was too many different ways of actually approaching different issues. Policing didn't know which way to turn. So having that grip on what is important on a national basis is really important. So massively supportive in relation to that. The new powers for the inspectorate as well. I mean, I don't want to be a regulator. It won't be me. My successor doesn't want to be a regulator. I know that. The inspectorate's important, but recommendations are great as long as policing is actually taking those recommendations and doing them quickly. Now, mostly our recommendations get addressed, but not always quickly enough. I can give you so many examples of where that has led to problems in policing. The powers direct, which my successor, if the white paper goes through, will receive, will mean that they can direct a chief to do something in the way that they say it should be done. Now, I don't do that lightly, but just having the threat of being able to do that will certainly focus chiefs' minds on what needs to be done for public safety reasons. Alongside that, there's a number of other powers that the inspectors will be getting as well, which won't make us a regulator, but will certainly give us more teeth than we have now.
And it also looks at national targets, and I suppose the fear is this going to be return of the target culture of the 2000s, I suppose?
Targets do have a bad name. I mean, performance management got a bad name. I don't have a problem with targets as long as they're the right targets. And the way that these targets are being drafted now is with policing, not to policing. So, you know, the senior police officers are involved in identifying what the targets should be. We've seen far too much of a drop-off in police productivity over the last 10, 15 years, far too much, which has resulted in too few people being brought to justice. And that's not good for community safety. So focusing policing on the issues that matter, both locally and nationally, and doing that in a constructive way, doing that in a way that resources are placed correctly as opposed to just move from A to B at a whim, is really important. So I don't fear a target culture as long as it isn't the be-all and end-all, because the targets itself, underneath that, is all the performance information you need to see why that target isn't being met. Sometimes it will be the fault of the police. Quite often it'll be the fault of other issues, other agencies, et cetera, et cetera. So professional performance management, I'm all in favour of. Just picking a target out of the air and saying you must go and achieve that is the wrong way to do it. There's always the fear as well, obviously, of targets being used in the wrong way by chiefs to make them look better. That's a failure of leadership when that happens. And as an inspector, it will always hold those chiefs to account if that is the case, if there is perverse incentives being offered.
Well, finally, regarding the white paper, it suggests that the Majesty's government will invest £115 million to create a national centre for AI in policing. And that includes the funding for, I think, 40 new live facial recognition vans. So clearly a major investment in AI. Do you think the police are ready for this change? Police, again, have been historically reluctant to change. And as you pointed out, and I know personally, some forces have embraced AI to good effect. It's obviously had some bad press very recently, which made national news. And then so there are some forces that I know of that are really reluctant to take on the AI technology. So how can we make that situation better for those that are wary of jumping in?
Policing can't afford not to embrace AI. It's a matter of fact. It's going to be the life moving forward. And police needs to be at the front end, not the back end of it. Police has been at the back end of far too many technological developments over the years. it needs to be the front end of this. And I'm glad to say there are some really innovative forces around the country who are embracing it. Now, there is always the ethical issue with AI and making sure that it is fair in the way that it actually produces the results that it produces. And we all need to be very careful around that. But this new approach by the government of having this police AI approach is the right way to do it, because you can test, you innovate. If things aren't working, or if things are shown to be unfair in the way that they are turning out, then it's only right that you should go back to the drawing board and look again. But policing can't afford to be at the back of the queue in relation to this, because criminality won't be.
The funding also provides for 40 new live facial recognition vans. Do you think the public are ready for this level of surveillance?
I think the public receive greater surveillance from CCTV cameras than they will from live facial recognition. Bear in mind as well that when a live facial recognition image is taken, if it doesn't hit a match, it's immediately destroyed. So it's not like CCTV, which is kept for weeks, months sometimes. I think it's far less intrusive. Now, what we need to guard against in relation to it is to make sure that it is really highly accurate. Because, you know, we're currently doing an inspection around facial recognition. And does it actually identify people from all nationalities, from all ethnic minorities in the right way? And we need to guard against that. We need to make sure that it's not unfair in its application, that it's not identifying people wrongly. But from all I've seen so far, it is going in absolutely the right direction in its accuracy. And if that results in keeping people safe on the streets, if that, as it has done and will continue to do so, catches rapists, people who want for violent offences, people who want for murder through its use, then I'm all in favour of it.
Now, well-being is a hot topic, and frustratingly so, we seem to talk about this every single year. The Oscar Kilo Wellbeing Survey of last year reported that 45% of officers felt burnt out. And I suppose, as an inspector of police forces, do you think that they are doing enough to manage the well-being of their officers?
Overall, no. Some forces are far better than others, and that's a problem in itself, the inconsistency of approach. And we found in our inspections there's a real disparity. Those forces who put well-being at the forefront tend to do it well. Those to whom it's an afterthought, the staff morale, the staff well-being obviously suffers as a result of that. We saw some good examples of this during the disorder that happened, gosh, when was it? Not last summer, but the summer before, wasn't it now? Where some forces were really good at dealing with those welfare issues, because it was at the forefront of the minds in doing so. And officers felt valued and supported as a result of it. But we saw the absolute opposite in some forces, but it was very much an afterthought, where they put their own well-being was not considered by more senior people or by the force as a whole. And that is going to have an impact, because when you're putting your people into dangerous situations, they should feel quite rightly that they're entitled to good welfare, good well-being, and to be cared for and looked after. That is not a consistent theme across policing in England and Wales at the moment, and certainly more needs to be done to ensure that officers and staff do feel that the force cares about them and the force will look after them.
Now, the well-being survey also stated that one third of the workforce have often gone to work when they feel they do not feel well enough to perform their duties, and officers often feel penalised by their own force policy sickness. I mean, this is a problem that's been going on for years now, hasn't it?
It is. You know, it's a difficult balance, isn't it? I mean, you know, just because someone's been off sick a number of occasions doesn't mean that they are slacking. So I do understand why forces have sickness policies in place. And if you hit a criteria, then that should lead to more conversations for two reasons. Not one, to make sure that the person involved isn't doing it because they don't like coming to work or something similar, but also to look at the well-being of that individual as well. Is there something the force can help with to actually get them at work more often than they are at work? But, you know, it's always happened. People have always come to work when they don't feel well enough to go to work. It's a very individual issue, isn't it? You know, I've done it myself on numerous occasions. not always for the right reasons, because at the end of the day, he can be spreading infection or anything else to everybody else. But the force policies shouldn't be so constrictive that people feel that they must come in when they feel distinctly unwell. So those force policies should spark a conversation, and then professional judgment should come on the back of that.
Well, this brings us on to the rising number of police officers, unfortunately, are taking their own lives. Obviously, there's no official figures, but there is an emerging picture of the organisation itself contributing to the decline in officer well-being, perhaps with protracted internal investigations and poor welfare support.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, any life lost is a tragedy, you know, and my thoughts are always with those officers and staff to whom it does happen. Sadly, you know, there is an increase in suicide across the country for various reasons, which are deep-seated reasons. But, you know, policing should be learning the lesson. It should be identifying those members of staff who are feeling under pressure due to work reasons or home reasons or whichever. And, you know, that to a great extent comes down to, firstly, good supervision and knowing your staff, understanding your staff, being approachable to your staff, making sure your staff know that they can come and speak to you if they have got those issues and they don't need to hide them. But on the back of that, there's a responsibility for the force involved as well to have the right actions in place, to have the right support in place to help those individuals and to help those first-line supervisors, whoever it is who are identifying the issues, to actually try and address some of the issues and to get people back into a better state of mind. But, you know, as I say, every death you read about, every suicide you read about within the service, it's always a shock. And we all need to look at how much more we can do to actually prevent that happening.
I mean, I know personally of two officers within the same police force. One had a really good experience when they were going through the mill, and the other one very definitely didn't. And you're probably right, it's down to supervision of why two people can have two totally opposite ends of the spectrum experiences within the same organisation.
Absolutely, and within the same organisation as well. I mean, you know, it may well be the processes were right, but the people involved didn't pick up on the issues as quickly as they should have done. I don't lay any blame on that because everyone is different. But at the end of the day, there shouldn't be that inconsistency of approach. People should know what the approach is to take. People who are suffering should know that there is support there for them, and forces should provide the resource to make sure that support is seen through.
I can't quantify this, and it's more of an observation rather than inviting you to make a comment, but with people's well-being taking a bit of a dive, I'm wondering whether that's connected with misconduct as police officers. I'm not using it as an excuse or mitigation, but if somebody's, you know, highly stressed or whatever that's got going on in their life, that could play a part. And then we have obviously the trauma of the internal inquiry then, and effectively being cut from the herd while that inquiry goes on.
Look, misconduct investigations can have a significant impact on individuals. There's no doubt about that. And the time that it takes to actually do those investigations can be a factor in that. I think now PSDs across the country get better training in relation to identifying, you know, some of the issues that they need to look out for when they're doing these investigations. Certainly, there should always be welfare support for those who are under investigation, particularly those who are suspended, because you can feel isolated, you're quite right. But police needs to be more consistent about the approach that it takes in relation to that. Yeah, no one wants to be under investigation. You know, on occasion, it's justified. On occasions, it comes out at the end that there was no issues to answer at all. But that suspension can have a big impact on people. So that support needs to be in place, whether that's from the Federation, Superintendent's Association, from other staff associations or unions. But also the force must ensure that it keeps that contact with those individuals too.
I recall my days on family protection, and certainly wellbeing support was part of the investigation strategy. And for people listening to the podcast, they might be surprised to know that not only was that offered to the complainant, but also the suspect, because not everybody is guilty. And obviously the nature of the offences we were dealing with were quite serious. And that doesn't seem to happen in the police. There doesn't seem to be, certainly from what I can see anyway, that there doesn't seem to be a welfare strategy for the officer under investigation.
it depends upon the risk assessment that's undertaken at the start of that. There should be. The welfare of any officers who are under investigation should be considered. I remember, you know, from my time as a chief in Merseyside, that there were significant issues on occasion in relation to doing that risk assessment and making sure that the contact was kept. Because despite the fact that, you know, suspension is not a prejudicial act, no one is guilty before the actual verdict comes out. So they are still part of the police family and they should still be treated as part of the police family.
I can hear officers screaming at me to ask you more questions about this, but I know we don't have too much time and it's a topic in and of itself. So I know time is short for us. Finally, as you leave law enforcement, you've got a new role, I believe, at Liverpool John Moores University. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I'm going to become a professor at John Moores and on police and investigations. Only 3 days a week. I'm going to do some other work as well in other fields as well as that. But I'm looking forward to having an opportunity to influence the next generation of police officers that will be looking after me when I'm getting older and need looking after. And hopefully putting them in the right direction to how important it is, what a fantastic job policing is, and how much you can get out of it if you do it right, in the right way, with the right approach and attitude. But, you know, as I said at the start, 41 years involved in police, and it's still the best job in the world, and it's still the best police service in the world.
I'm sure you were asked during your interview for The Post, what can Andy Cook bring to the role?
Hopefully a vast amount of experience, a good understanding of what makes a good cop, the ability to basically identify what the key issues are facing policing overall, nationally and locally, and a real desire to ensure that British policing continues to be at the forefront of policing in the world. I'm exceptionally proud that I was a police officer for 36 years before I came into this role. And I still have that real verve and vigour for showcasing the fantastic work that policing does on a daily basis. There's no job like it. I genuinely mean that. You can make a massive difference to people's lives for the better, sometimes for the worse, if you do the job properly, but you're keeping communities safe. And what better vocation can there be for that?
So I suppose finally then, what would Sir Andy Cook tell PC Andy Cook on his first day on independent patrol? What wise words would you pass on?
I think two things. One, it'd be learn from the people who you know are doing a good job. Have the right role models. It's very easy to identify when you join police in those whose hearts are in the job and who know exactly what the right thing to do is and who treat people with respect and dignity, who go after relentlessly the bad people who make communities' lives misery. So follow the right people. And also, the best advice my dad ever gave to me was, son, life's not fair, just get on with it. And you'll find that in policing, that is absolutely the case. You know, some things aren't fair, whether it's internally with promotions, whether it's externally seeing some of the things that people in our communities go through, the poor, sad lives they have and the difficulties they have. It's not fair. Just do your best. Just make sure that you are, on a daily basis, making someone's life a bit better.
Well, Sir Andy Cook, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure, Dave. Thank you for your time.
DCT Audio, the art of good listening.